Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkang namassami. Today is a special day in Theravadan Buddhist countries, especially in Thailand and Laos, Magga Puja. And as I was saying this morning, there's a couple of other special holidays or special days in Buddhism. There's Visakha Puja, which is a day that celebrates the enlightenment of the Buddha and his birth and death. And then there's Asala Puja, which commemorates when the Buddha first gave the first teaching, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, very important teaching, sort of supreme summary of the entire teachings and path and goal of Buddhism. So you can think of Visakha Puja as being a commemoration of the Buddha, and Asala Puja is commemorating the Dhamma. And today is Magga Puja. And this was a day when it's recorded that there was a spontaneous gathering of 1,250 enlightened disciples of the Buddha that came together. And it's used as an occasion to recollect the Sangha. So maybe it's a good time, it's an appropriate time just to say a few words about the Sangha. And why is it that we're recollecting the Sangha? What does that mean to recollect the Sangha? When I first met or laid eyes on the first person who I thought was a fully enlightened person in Thailand, it's a very memorable experience. I remember walking into the room, and he was seated on a seat, kind of raised seat, and it was tea time. And there were monks kind of gathered in a semicircle around the senior monk, and he was visiting and he was giving some teachings. And he was sitting there, he was so composed and still. And the impression that I remember very clearly was one of it's kind of hard to communicate, but sort of the grain of wood, the way it sort of fits so harmoniously into the kind of whole, the other grain of wood that kind of surrounds it. I had that sort of impression with this monk sitting there, and behind him was this kind of beautiful green forest and these kind of insect sounds, and I had this impression of just nature, just this kind of screen of nature that was sitting in front of me. And this being that I felt was enlightened was just one, was just harmonizing into the background sort of frame of nature. And he was so still and calm and composed and mature and relaxed and simple that it left a very strong impression on me. And yet this was a being who still had a very vibrant personality, in fact, a very playful person, and was very humorous as he spoke, and very kind and very gentle. And it made me think, or it makes me think now anyways, what it must be like to be with the Buddha. You see a being, just one being, who I have the faith, say, who is fully enlightened. And it's just beings come from all over just to see this person, just to see one person who's enlightened. The whole village comes out from Bung Wai to pay respects to this one monk who's come to visit. And it's because we have faith in his wisdom. We have faith that this is a person who's attained to the highest goal of Buddhism. So just try and imagine that. If you're with, say, the Buddha, and with him is, say, his two chief disciples, Mahamoggallana and Sariputta, and then there's Mahakassapa, the father of the Sangha, he's sometimes referred to as, and then Ananda, the great attendant to the Buddha, Mahakachana. There's so many great beings. And just trying to picture a whole room sitting quietly, a whole room, 10, 15, 20 monks or nuns that are fully enlightened, say they're beyond any doubt, their hearts are absolutely pure, and they're just sitting together peacefully in a state of mindfulness and composure. And that is an awesome image to me. And that's very worth doing here, especially in the West, where the monastics, a community of monastics, are very rare. In Thailand, it's actually much easier to think about how special the Sangha is, because the Sangha is all about you. You see them on alms round. You go to, there's monasteries everywhere, that there's tens of thousands of monks and nuns living in Thailand. Whereas in the United States of America, it's quite rare. And so we really have to remember that we're part of a lineage, that we are part of a tradition that is a vehicle of truths that are so precious and valuable that it can liberate the human heart. And not, it's not that the truths liberate them, but they're instructions that are there and they're available to anybody who wishes to notice and to pay attention. The Sangha, there's sometimes, what does the Sangha mean? That's a worthwhile question. And there's two kinds of interpretations or understanding what a Sangha is, usually. There's the conventional Sangha. And the conventional Sangha is simply the community of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, monks and nuns, who have received the ordination under the Buddha and the Buddha's disciples. That's the conventional Sangha. And that's a very important Sangha. It's a very worthwhile community to encourage and to support. And support either through simply becoming one of them is one way to support them, or to support them materially with simply enough so that they can survive and live and practice. The other Sangha, you could call it the Aryan Sangha. The community of enlightened beings. And this is not just monks and nuns, this also includes lay people. And there are many, say, monks and nuns who may not be part of the Arya Sangha, in fact, the majority. The Arya Sangha are those beings, monks, nuns, lay women, lay men, who have freed the heart to a level where they've attained a stage of enlightenment. And sometimes people ask the question, lay people will ask the question, is it possible for a lay person today, really, Ajahn Yadiko, tell me, do I have any chance of attaining stream entry? Like lay people will ask sometimes. I think, to be fair, I remember asking this to Ajahn, one teacher in Thailand once, who I have great faith in, and he was very adamant. He was, absolutely, absolutely. He goes, there's no question about it. But let's face it, it's difficult. It's a difficult task, even if you're a monastic. It's that much more difficult if you have a job working 9 to 5 and you're exposed to all kinds of things which take you away from your purpose. An analogy comes to my mind. It's like somebody asking, is it possible to be a world-class piano player and yet at the same time have a 9 to 5 job working at a factory or working somewhere and having, maybe a husband and a couple of children? Well, the answer is maybe it's possible, but it's actually quite unlikely because to be a real world-class piano player, you have to dedicate your whole life to that goal. And if you're just going to be, if you have a job 9 to 5 and you kind of attend social events like a normal person, you're probably not going to be dedicated enough to achieve that level of mastery. Or another example is is it possible to be a gold or say a Olympic medalist, swimmer, and at the same time just have a job and some children and a family? And the answer is, well, it's not, theoretically it's not impossible. And if you put in enough hours, if you give everything you've got, and every spare moment you kind of dedicate yourself to training, in swimming, well, maybe it's possible. Maybe it's not impossible. But you could see how somebody who, let's say they're part of a, they don't have a job, they don't have a family, and they're part of a, like a training group. They have a coach, and they kind of, every day they go to the swimming pool, and they do their training. That's the kind of person who is much more likely to be a medalist, an Olympic medalist. But one thing that is different, say, from being a Buddhist to being wanting to be a gold medalist or something like that, in Buddhism, we do have faith in karma, in the faith in rebirth. And sometimes this is not spoken of much in the West because it's such a foreign concept and it seems kind of strange. You know, how can it be that after I die, I'll get another body? That just seems so unlikely and so strange, even irrational. But nonetheless, it's a very strange concept to many people. But you can appreciate how if you have faith in that concept, and let's say enlightenment, instead of being like a gold medalist, think of it as being like you simply have to put in enough hours of meditation and giving and sharing and arousing wholesome mind states. You have to do it enough. And at some point, eventually, enlightenment is realized. And even if you're a layperson, it's kind of like, well, it doesn't matter if you're a layperson or if you're a monk. Every moment that you get a chance to make merit, to cultivate what is wholesome, to do what is wholesome, to do what is good, you're sort of putting money in the bank account, as it were. You're making progress towards the goal of enlightenment. And this should be not understated. Sometimes it can be, say, in Thailand, many Buddhists will think of making merit as an opportunity to achieve a good rebirth so that they kind of wind up in a heaven state. And that's okay, actually. That's not against the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha is very clear that heaven exists. You know, being reborn in heaven is a result of keeping precepts, developing generosity, kindness, loving kindness. Heaven exists and there's a way to get there. But he also points out that there's drawbacks to heavenly rebirth. If you're born in heaven, and if it is blissful, imagine you are born in a blissful, blissful state, and you're there for hundreds of years, thousands of years in a blissful body. What happens is there's simply a growing sense of attachment to that experience. It's like, oh, this is so wonderful. I don't want it to end. And through that attachment, you're simply increasing the causes of selfishness and thereby promoting this whole process again of the wheel of samsara, where we go up and we go down. We have good births, we have bad births. We have good mental states, we have bad mental states. It's the whole process, this endless process of never finding a land, a home, a ground where we can say, this is final. This is the resting place. It's this constant movement, and we're constantly subject to the challenge of uncertainty. There's no point at which we can say, this is it, this is certain. This is a state of existence which is eternal. That simply doesn't exist according to the Buddha's teachings. So while, say, in Buddhism, it's kind of nice because the causes that lead to good rebirths and to happy states are the same causes that are the foundation for the pursuit of freedom, the pursuit of enlightenment. Basic causes, basic foundations, virtue, kindness, morality, generosity, and on a higher level, mental training, where you train the mind in meditation. So tonight we remember this event where there were 1,250 enlightened beings coming together, and we imagine what that must have been like. 1,250 monks coming together, sitting down, surrounding the Buddha, and the Buddha giving a teaching. And it's interesting, these were fully enlightened monks, but the teaching that the Buddha gives is a very basic teaching. It's very down-to-earth teaching. He simply says, the most quoted part of this teaching is to refrain from what is evil, to cultivate what is skillful, and to purify the mind. And this is the teaching of the Buddhas. It's a very nice, succinct, simple summary of what Buddhism is. There's once a talk I listened to of Ajahn Chah once, and Ajahn Chah was asked, what is Buddhism? These were some Thais, I think they were living in America, and they said sometimes Westerners ask them, what is Buddhism? And they get all flustered as soon as they get asked, what is Buddhism? And Ajahn Chah just simply quoted this passage, to avoid what is evil, to do what is good, and to purify the mind. So as we practice our path and develop the practice, I just want to encourage everybody to set your sights on freedom, on liberation. Part of what the Buddha says here is that Nibbana is the highest happiness. It is supreme. And that's something to kind of think on and reflect on. Nibbana is the highest happiness. And this is what, in our heart of hearts, we want to find something which is a happiness which is not dependent on anything, which can't be taken away from us, which can't be lost, which doesn't depend on favors from anybody. This is a happiness that we have to work out solely on our own, with guidance, but through our own efforts. That's a very noble sort of happiness. It's not something that you can ask for from anyone else. It's not something that praying for will help, or wishful thinking. In our hearts, there lies the cause of suffering. There lies the greed that's in our hearts that will always have negative consequences. And the heart which is free from greed is a heart which is open and spacious. It's a heart which is free to think of other people. It's free to care without being lost in its own self-interest. The heart of hate is such a painful state to be in. To feel addicted to the kind of the need to be more powerful than someone else. The need to see other people being lower than you. And that's extremely painful. And what's most painful about it is eventually you have to understand what you've done. When you've hurt others, you can hurt others and you can do it again and again and again. And you can deny what it feels like. But eventually you're going to have two options. Either one is to carry on cultivating hate, or the other is to face it and to admit what you've done and to realize what you've done through your hate. And that hurts. And that's not to say that you should therefore hate yourself. I mean, that's also not the point. But it's to recognize that ill will can only have negative results. There's no other way for it. So our hearts are burdened by these things that we call kilesas, defilements, greed, hatred, delusion, laziness. These things weigh down the heart. They're like rocks that just burden the heart, make it heavy, make it unsure of itself. The poison relationships. And it's hard to free the heart. It's hard to set the heart free. It's not an easy task. But it is something that the Buddha says can be done. He says, this is something that we can do, and it's in our interest. He said, if it was incapable for us to do this, he would not encourage us to do it. If it were to lead to any kind of harm to us, he would not encourage us to do it. But since we can do it, and since it leads to the highest happiness, therefore he encourages us to cultivate what is wholesome, what is good, and to abandon what is unwholesome. So the Sangha is like, it's like a beacon. It's showing us that it is possible for humans to attain these states. And through attaining these states, through cultivating and doing whatever we can to move in that direction, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just a tiny step every day towards cultivating the wholesome and abandoning the unwholesome, that's progress. That is progress on the path. And we're moving that much closer to being part of the Aryan Sangha. We're making progress. We're making a deposit. We're filling the jar, as it were, that water. There's a simile of the jar and the water that's dripping into a big pot, just one drop at a time. And you fill up this pot one drop at a time, drop after drop after drop, year after year, and eventually that pot is full. And there comes a time when just one more drop of water and that jar overflows. And it was a jar that was filled up with just one drop at a time. Or the image of water against rock. We've seen how powerful something as soft as water can be through just its consistent and continuous rubbing against the rock. It can make something as hard as rock become very soft and smooth just through its own relentless consistency. So in this teaching that the Buddha gives, he says, patience is the supreme austerity. And sometimes we, in ancient times and today in some religions or some practitioners, they can sometimes resort to being hard on themselves, thinking that this is a good thing. And what's really valuable about any kind of austerity is not the fact that you're sitting up all night or fasting or bearing with just kind of putting yourself through pain, but it's the fact that you're calling upon yourself to be patient. Patience always goes against the grain, the defilements. So whenever you have an opportunity to be patient, you're in the car and there's a traffic jam. You're in the Dhamma hall and you're listening to a Dhamma talk that seems to be going on and on. And you feel restless. This is an opportunity. An opportunity to cultivate patience. And whenever you're cultivating patience, then you're cultivating the path. And not just a blind patience, not just the kind of patience where you just grin and bear it and just kind of try and get through it. But where you actually mindfully embrace the moment. And you feel what it feels like and the kind of tension that comes basically from ill will. It's kind of aversion to the present moment. You notice that aversion and you undo it through mindfulness. And it's actually an easy thing to do. When you convince yourself it's difficult, that itself is the kilesa trying to fool you. If you say, no, actually this is easy to be patient in this situation, then it is easy. Some of the teachings that the Buddha gives in the on this day, in the Uvadapatimokkha, seem specifically aimed towards the monks. He encourages the monks to cultivate seclusion, cultivate wakefulness. Seclusion is important in meditation simply because when we expose ourselves to the world, the mind tends towards proliferation and diversity. The mind does not unify. So as monastics, and someone who's really very seriously bent on meditation, there's a need for developing a love for seclusion. Not out of a fear of pain, but out of a love of the depth of stillness and the sense that in seclusion one is free from so many projections that the world is trying to put on you, trying to tell you you have to be a certain way, you have to look a certain way, you have to own certain symbols. All that is, we're very subject to it. It's very easy to manipulate people who are lost in greed and hatred. Show me somebody who has strong greed and strong hatred, and I'll show you somebody who's easy to manipulate. Show me somebody who has no greed and no hatred, and I'll show you somebody who's free and who is not easy to manipulate. So we use tonight, we will recollect the lineage that we come from, a great history of monastics. the whole reason that we're here, just think if Ajahn Mun, you know, Ajahn, one of Ajahn Chah's main teachers, if he didn't go forth, and if he didn't spend all those years wandering in solitude, which he did, month after month, he was asked to be an abbot. And there's a famous story once where he, at a big monastery, I think it was in Chiang Mai, the abbot asked him if he would consider, he was a very influential abbot, and he asked him if he would, Ajahn Mun, if he would take over running the monastery. And Ajahn Mun said, "I'll tell you in the morning." Something to that effect. And next morning he disappeared. He was out, he hit the forest. And he was out wandering. He was a wanderer. And it's easy for some people, they might say, "Ajahn Mun, I mean, he just spent all those years in the forest. How self-centered. You know, that's the pinnacle of selfishness." But it's not. Buddha, when he says, why did the Buddha live secluded? He gave two reasons. One was because he has compassion for future generations. In other words, he saw that it was actually beneficial for future generations. And the other was because, he said very honestly, because he's devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. And that's what a forest is. Seclusion is a very beautiful, peaceful abiding. And for monastics, or for those who are bent on the goal, seclusion, at least occasional seclusion, and that's what meditation is, really. It's mental seclusion. It's something we have to come to and come to terms with. You know, we were born into this world alone, and we'll die alone. And there's no relationship that we can establish that will cure us or save us from that reality. So we have to come to terms with a certain kind of inescapable solitude. And so we are here as a result of Ajahn Mun. And through Ajahn Mun going forth, he had hundreds of disciples, and Ajahn Chah, and he had hundreds of disciples. And so on it goes. Goodness begets goodness. And this wheel of Dhamma is going to keep rolling depending on the integrity with which Buddhists practice. Where does religion lie? It relies in the hearts of the practitioners. It certainly doesn't rely in the buildings or the Buddha images or the rituals. All those are just surface, superficial appearances. But where the religion really lies is going to be in the hearts of individual practitioners. And as long as the religion is flourishing there, then we can say Buddhism is flourishing. When we cease to practice it properly, when we cease to be striving for enlightenment, that's when Buddhism ceases to have meaning. So tonight we express our gratitude to our teacher, Ajahn Pasano. You know, none of us would be here if it wasn't for Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro, who basically established this monastery. Ajahn Pasano wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Ajahn Chah. And truly, we're inheritance. We are the descendants of the Buddha. And one of my favorite lines in the entire Tipitaka, that after the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths and he set rolling the wheel of Dhamma, it's said that the earth gods, sort of the deities that abide on the earthly plane, they rejoiced. And they said, the wheel of Dhamma has been set rolling by the Buddha, and no one, no god, no Mara, no Brahma, no king, no monk, no layperson, nobody can stop it from rolling. And that was after Ananda, his chief disciple, Kundanya, his first disciple, he understood the teaching. And at that point, the Sangha was born. At that point, the wheel of Dhamma had started rolling from the Buddha to Kundanya, and from there on, enlightenment was going to flourish and roll on, and it wasn't going to be set or stopped by anybody. And that's because of the power of the Buddha's virtue and wisdom. And now, the Buddha said very clearly, it's not going to roll forever. Like all former Buddhas, like everything, everything arises and passes away, and the Buddha set forth the Dhamma, set forth the teaching, and it will survive for as long as his disciples, that is us, practice. But in time, practice deteriorates. The conditions to practice cease to be supportive. And we can see that happening around us now. With each passing year, there's more chaos in the world. There is. There seems to be more diffuseness, more capacity for distraction, more opportunity for doubt, more opinions. Buddhism is eventually going to disappear, and that's simply what the Buddha says. Now, of course, what happens is as it disappears for a long time, perhaps, probably, but then eventually, once Buddhism is entirely gone, the teachings are entirely gone, passed away, forgotten, when the conditions are right, there arises another being who has realized the same truths, the Four Noble Truths, that are eternal truths. And the Eightfold Path, it's an eternal truth, it's an internal truth that is always there to be realized by anybody who turns the mind to realize it. And after this cycle of Buddhism disappears, another Buddha arises, and he realizes those same truths, and he proclaims those same truths, and Buddhism arises again, or say the teachings arise again. So this is our opportunity. Tonight we will recollect the Sangha, recollect the incredible gratitude that we have to all of our teachers and all the beings who have helped us find the way and direct us towards what is valuable and meaningful and wholesome. And we'll dedicate the merit to the enlightenment of our own enlightenment and to all beings. And we wish all beings to be free from delusion, all beings to be free from suffering. That's the whole purpose of our practice. And that's what we will strive to do tonight. So I think I'll end the talk there.